Let's start. We'll talk again, like the first next 15 minutes or so, about mechatronics in general. Mechatronics is kind of a weird word. There's a journal called Mechatronics. Actually, we have a couple papers in. And they have a big, long description about what mechatronics is about and kind of a synergistic combination of mechanical and electrical and computing and et cetera. But basically, in my mind, mechatronics really, by that definition, really defines most things that are kind of fun, cool, or useful from an engineering perspective. Right, this combination of mechanical and electrical and control systems. So if you think about it from that perspective, what do we need to do to be able to design mechatronic systems? And really, in a lot of ways, any kind of modern system, we need to know some mechanical engineering, of course, or we need to have this knowledge on our team. We had to do some electrical engineering, some computer science, probably some material science, right, in terms of picking the right kind of materials, et cetera, et cetera. All right, so there's a bunch we need to know. It's a pretty good diagram from RPI that basically puts mechatronics at the center of all these different disciplines. Right? And I think this is a cool place to work and a cool place. You know, one reason I like to research kind of in this area is you get to work with really smart people from all those different disciplines. Right? And that is a lot of fun. Control systems, mechatronics shows up everywhere. Aerospace to oil and gas to pure kind of robotics, if you will, to manufacturing automation. So it's a place you get to work across many different disciplines, or with many different people from many different disciplines. So what does that mean? You have a team that have all these different backgrounds on it. What becomes really important then?
Communication.
Technical communication, right? So like we've been talking throughout the entire semester, and we'll keep trying to drill home to you guys, is being able to effectively communicate your ideas is a critical component of being a good engineer. Critical component of being an engineer in general. Right? If you can't communicate your ideas effectively, your ideas aren't effective. Okay, that's just the foundation of it. Right? So effective communication is essential. Mechatronic design basically follows an iterative process. We'll kind of slide through this pretty quickly. But basically, a lot of this part of it happens in the detailed design phase, which is why we'll go through it quickly right now. But it itself becomes an iterative process. Right, in terms of picking out the forces you need, what kind of actuators do I need, motors and things, to supply those forces? What kind of sensors do I need to measure the environment or the forces I'm working with? How fast do I need to process those inputs in order to achieve the functionality I want? And that becomes an iterative process itself. Okay. And the key point that makes it kind of mechatronics rather than, you know, electrical then mechanical or mechanical then electrical is you're doing all this together. It's kind of a concurrent process. You don't design the mechanical system and say, okay, I'm done with that. Now I need to figure out the electronics. And now I'm done with that. Now I need to figure out the control system. Right? The idea is that you're designing all three of those things together. And if you're thinking about how you can control the system from the very beginning, that should have some effect on how what the mechanical design looks like. Right? So for example, one example from my research, we do a lot of vibration control. Right? So if we know that we have these algorithms that can control vibration effectively, then maybe my welding robot that's putting the welding cars together doesn't need to be as stiff as they traditionally are, which means it probably can be lighter, which means it probably can use less energy. So by considering that control system earlier in the process or concurrently with the mechanical design of the system, I can have advantages over the overall design. So that's kind of the idea. We'll skip through this one again pretty quickly. Basically looking at all the considerations for selecting actuators. We're primarily going to look at DC motors because that's most of what you get in your kit that we give you, which we'll start working on pretty soon too. So let's take a look, a brief run through of DC motors. Let's start with brushed DC motors. When you think of a DC motor, this is probably what you're thinking about, an old school brushed DC motor. Internally, it looks something like this. So you have permanent magnets on the outside, typically. And it's usually more than two. This is kind of a simplified version. Right? You have the armature inside, which are the kind of electromagnetic components. So that's kind of electrical name of these guys. So you have a coil there. And you have the commutator, which actually functions to switch the direction of current through those coils. And by doing so, switch the polarity of the magnetic field. Okay? And then you have these two brushes, which in most modern DC motors, brush DC motors, are not actually brushes any longer. They were kind of originally. But there is metal-to-metal contact, or conductor-to-conductor, not always metal, conductor-to-conductor contact between the brushes and the commutator. Okay, so current flows into your motor, through the commutator, through the coil, not that way. Okay. The mechanical components, we have the rotor, that's the part that rotates, or the stator, the part that stays still. Okay. So in its current configuration, probably tell by the arrows on this guy, what does this motor want to do? What is the rotor, which direction does the rotor want to go? Right, so we have kind of north pole and north and south and the south. So these guys are repelling, wants to start turning that motor. And that's what will happen. And this is the first shot you'll get at that guy. So you notice that the commutator has this gap in it, right? So in this orientation, we're flowing in one direction around the coils, right? When we go around this gap, the current will start flowing the opposite direction. So you'll see the polarity of the electromagnetic change once it passes the gap. So we get up to, whoops, sorry, first rotation. We'll get there. First rotation, we get halfway over. Now the southern pole is attracting the electromagnetic side. This guy's attracting as well. We're going to keep rotating. And then once we plus, you see the polarity of the electromagnets on the rotor changes. Right. So once we pass that gap in the commutator, now this guy is repelling and pushing. And all we need to do for this guy, for this DC motor to work, this brush DC motor, is drop a voltage across the terminals. Okay. And away it goes. And it keeps rotating that way. Okay. Look inside a brush DC motor. It's kind of a cheap little hobby one. You'll see what looks remarkably similar to the diagram I just showed you. Okay. Take it apart. You can look down kind of into the back of it. You see in this case we have two permanent magnets, one on each side. And then you have kind of three-pole stator or rotor. And you see in this case the brushes are actually just two metal tabs that ride on the commutator. Okay. So if I control a brush DC motor, right, I said all we need to do in order to make this thing turn is drop some voltage across its terminals. So how do I control the speed then? I can control that voltage. Okay. If I have, however, like most modern control systems, only a digital output, I only have 0 or 5 volts or 0 or 12 volts, how then can I control the speed of that motor? So I could put some kind of resistor network and do a voltage divider and that kind of thing. What that's going to happen there is I'm just going to waste a ton of energy. Because all that voltage drop across the resistors is just generating heat. The capacitor, you're going to put a capacitor generally in parallel with these guys to store energy when you need a big pulse. But that's not going to change the speed, though. So I could pulse it, sure. Let's look at pulse width modulation. Or PWM, okay? And it's a method to control the speed of brush DC motors. So it works kind of this way. So I have a digital output. I either have kind of zero or whatever my VMAX is, either 0 or 5 volts, 0 or 12 volts, 0 or 48, whatever that voltage happens to be, okay? So with a digital output, if I'm just either on or off, I have one speed I can turn that motor. Okay. However, if I take that digital output and I kind of switch it on and off rapidly with respect to the dynamics of the motor, normally 20,000 times a second is how quickly this happens. If I look at that, what's the average voltage across these pulses? About half, right? So as long as this pulse is kind of quick compared to the dynamics of the motor, the motor doesn't have time to speed up and slow down at each pulse. it's going to see kind of like the average of this command, right? So this is about half. This is called a 50% duty cycle. So the duty cycle of a PWM command is how long it's on, right? So this is on 50% of the time. Okay. If you look at this one, same kind of max voltage, but now I'm on only 10% of the time. So I have a 10% duty cycle. Okay. So that's PWM. Quite often, your microcontroller, the Pi board, has much higher resolution PWM than an Arduino board, one of the big strengths of it. You're actually not going to be controlling the motor directly from the Pi board, right? But you're still going to communicate with the motor driver via PWM. So the duty cycle of your PWM command does issue a command to the motor driver what speed it should be trying to turn the motor. Okay. And in some cases, the PWM is actually turning on a H-bridge, which we can talk about later if you want. Okay. Brushed DC motors can be made very cheap because they're simple to design and control. Okay. Cheap to integrate with something, as you saw in your toothbrush. Right, that's a brushed DC motor that was inside that guy. All you needed to do is drop a battery across the terminals, and it's fine. Okay, you don't really need control. Let's say, right? I just need a voltage from somewhere. Right. That because they're simple to design and control and relatively cheap, they can be made robust to various environments. Right, they're pretty tough motors for the most part. You can get wear. You do have conductor-to-conductor contact there, so those brushes can wear. Modern brushed DC motors are much better about this, but you can get sparking because of that connection as well. So if you're in an environment that has flammables around, be careful with brushed DC motors. The alternative to brushed DC motors are called brushless DC motors. And basically, the commutation is moved from the rotor to the stator. So instead of having the electromagnet on the inside and the permanent magnet on the outside, we have the permanent magnet as the rotor. Okay? And this requires a controller, because now I need to control the magnetic field around the stator in order to make this motor move. So in the current configuration, it's kind of static, so what I'd have to do is advance my magnetic field around, and then the rotor is going to kind of chase the magnetic field effectively. Okay. So I would advance it again, and then keep turning that way. Right. And that does require a controller to do that commutation for you. Right. That's not happening mechanically any longer. Okay. This is really similar how AC motor works as well. Okay. And you just keep spinning this way. Brushless motors tend to be very precise. You have less internal friction than you do in a brushed DC motor, generally. They tend to be very quiet as well compared to brushed DC motors. Right? You don't have those components rubbing against each other inside, creating noise. Okay? They tend to have low electromagnetic interference compared to a brushed DC motor, because you don't have coils spinning any longer. You have a permanent magnet. Right? And you're able to control the electronic field around. Right? The only big benefit with these guys is they can be fully enclosed. Right, so you get rid of that sparking concern you have with brushed DC motors. The big con is that you do need a controller to do it for you. Right, so you can't just drop a voltage across a brushless DC motor. It's not going to do anything, basically. And quite often you can actually damage it. And they are still a little bit more expensive than a brushed DC motor. It's a more complex mechanism. Stepper motors are kind of a type of brushless motor. You're going to get a stepper motor as part of your kit we're going to give you. Right? You're going to get a few different brushed DC motors. You're going to get a stepper motor. So this is a stepper motor with the back pulled off of it. Anybody have a 3D printer? I got to talk to a couple of you who have 3D. So most 3D printers actually use brushless stepper motors to control their print head. So stepper motors look like this. And here you see the rotor has this kind of weird kind of tooth shape. But what that allows us to do is something like this. So you see, the rotor has that kind of tooth shape, and then your coils also have a similar kind of tooth shape. Okay? And by energizing these coils in different patterns, I can cause the rotor to move kind of one step at a time, which is why it's called a stepper motor. Okay? So you look at this first case, you see that these four guys are kind of lined up with those four. Okay? So if I turn that coil off, and I turn this other one on, this one to the right, you see that these are not really aligned right now. Okay? But if I energize that coil, I get a traction now, and they want to be aligned. Okay? And then I can look at that next coil, and well, it's not really quite aligned right now either. But if I energize it, I can move one more step. Okay? So I can keep stepping around by energizing these coils in sequence. Yes?
So whenever you energize this one coil at a time, you can actually essentially hold it in place?
Yes. So stepper motors are really good for positioning tasks. Stepper motor is not something you're going to use to drive a RC car or something like that, right? It's good for positioning things because you effectively, you can make the assumption, if you design everything rightly, that this motor is not going to get back driven by whatever it's trying to move. It has enough torque to actually move its shaft. So then you know how many steps your motor has. If I have a 200-step stepper motor, which is a common size, I know it takes 200 steps for me to make one rotation. So I can count the number of steps and know how far my motor has turned. The way that's done mechanically will change based on the quality of motor, kind of, yeah. And you can also play other games by energizing more than one coil and kind of getting stuck in between. So you can do micro-stepping modes, is what those are called. But effectively, stepper motors are really good at positioning tasks. Yeah?
So the number of teeth on the gear will actually determine how much the angle is.
How many steps there are, yeah, that's right. Yep. So I think the picture is probably the picture I showed. Oops. This guy, I think, is a 200-step motor. So you see, it's kind of quite a number more than you see in the picture. I think this is actually one from. Yeah, I think this is one from this class. Same model you guys get. You do definitely get a 200-step motor. And these motors are good at really fine positioning. And yes, sir. Yes. Yes. So a stepper motor, you generally, like at startup, you can't say go to 30 degrees, but you can keep track of the number of steps you've asked it to move, and then know you're at 30 degrees because you moved 15 steps or whatever. Yeah. So that's what the 3D printers. Instead of having sensors on where the printer head is, they're just counting steps that those motors are turning. That's why when you turn one of those on for first time, usually it moves over to a corner and hits some switches and says, hey, that's zero, when it runs into that switch. And then from there, it knows how many steps it takes to move around the environment and print the stuff. So you can use these in some cases, which we'll talk about right now, can allow you to get away from needing a sensor to sense positioning. So if you know the number of steps and you assume it hasn't been back driven or hasn't required too much torque, you can use that as a proxy for how far I've traveled. Right? Tend to be quiet, a lot of the same pros as a brushless DC motor with kind of better positioning. Right? The other thing steppers are pretty good at in terms of your final design is kind of holding a position where the torque curve is kind of set up. They have really high torque at low speed, right? So they're kind of set up to hold a position and do positioning, not running at high speed. But like the brushless motor, you need a controller. Luckily, we give you guys one. It makes it easy to use. And they can be higher initial costs. So a really cheap brushless or really cheap brushed DC motor, $1 maybe. I think you're not going to find a stepper motor for less than $6 or $8 probably. So they're kind of a bit more expensive. And then you have low torque at speed. You have pretty high holding torque, but low torque at high speed for stepper motors. Kind of like another category of motors is called servo motors or servos. Servo motors most generally describe motors that have some kind of form of feedback built into them or to their control. Okay, so I have some kind of sensor coupled with my motor that's telling me the shaft angle or the shaft angular velocity, or both. Okay, and you're typically going to use potentiometers or encoders. So here, actually, in this picture, is the system I use for a big chunk of my PhD research, kind of a small-scale tower crane, like you see building skyscrapers, about 2 meters tall, kind of lab-size version of that crane. And you look at this motor here at the top that controls the rotation. It's a Siemens motor, and it's kind of gearbox and everything. And it has basically an encoder on the shaft. So it's a dual shaft motor. It's kind of how quite often how these are done. You have one shaft kind of going out one side that actually drives the load. You have another shaft coming out the back that you attach your sensor to so you can follow the same angle and know the angle of the motor. Okay. So this is actually an AC servo motor, essentially a brushless motor, using Siemens branded encoder on the back shaft. Okay. So we know with really high precision for this motor, it's the angle it's rotated through for all time. Okay. You guys have a servo motor in your kit, right, that you purchased. It's a smaller version of one that looks like this. These hobby-style servo motors are really servo motors. If you take them apart, they're pretty impressive little pieces of engineering. They will have a gear train. Yours actually has metal gears, so that's a big step up. And then if you take it apart a little further, you'll see there is typically a brushed DC motor, right? So a brushed DC motor and then some electronics up here. Okay? And what that electronics is doing, it's basically reading a potentiometer, right? Reading has some sensor on the angle of the output shaft. And then the internal electronics is trying to turn this internal DC motor to make the shaft match what you told it to go to. Okay. So these hobby servos, pretty nice little deals, right? These guys, the ones in your kit, are not going to be able to supply a ton of torque. They're better for pulling a pen or something like that than they are for driving some big mechanism. Okay. And of course, we can control them with the Pi board, which we'll do probably on Thursday. Okay. And you have actually 4 pins on your board kind of dedicated to these hobby servo control on the Pi board. Okay. Let's talk about sensors. When do we need a sensor? Want some kind of action to stop or start? Maybe. I might be able to know that without a sensor, though, right? So when do I need a sensor to tell me that? I want to know if something's in front of me. I think that's in the right direction for sure. Yeah, I need some kind of feedback about the state of my system or the state of the environment. Okay. So basically, if my operation is dependent upon the environment, I probably need some sensor to know what's going on in the environment. So some examples of that are kind of pick-and-place robots, right? So pick up a component in a factory and send it, move it somewhere else for assembly, pick-and-place. I need to know what I'm picking, and I need to know where it needs to go. Right? Obstacle avoidance is another one. Right? Autonomous vehicles spend $100,000 on sensors right now, right? For all those autonomous cars, those sensors are not cheap. The LiDAR, scanners, radar, GPS, et cetera. Okay. You also might need sensors if you need really precise operation, right? If your mechanical system is robust to there being some deviation in how the thing is working, maybe you can get away with an open loop control, we say. We're not using any measurements to dictate how it's moving, right? If you need really precise operation, you need to start measuring what's happening with your system and then correcting for any error from where you want it to be, right? And this is so important, we have a whole class dedicated to it, Mickey 474, control systems. Okay. Taking sensor input and deciding my output to the system, or my input to the mechanical system, in order to have more precise operation. It's a whole field of engineering, effectively, that last one. Here's a question for you. Can I get reliable acceleration data from a position sensor. A sensor that might measure position. That's a vote for no. Anybody voting for yes? Who votes no? Who votes yes? A few yeses. Who doesn't really care? Most of you, I think. Okay. So, let's look at a command and see if we can wrap our head around this. So, any sensor, even the best one you can buy, is going to have some noise associated with this signal. Right? We're not going to be able to measure the environment exactly. There's going to be some general noise in the sensor. So here I've drawn what I'm going to call a pure response in blue, just a sine wave, or cosine, I guess. And then I've added a little bit of noise on top. So you see the red one is kind of wiggling a little bit in addition to the blue. But if you just looked at this, you'd say, hey, if I have a sensor that's working this well, I'm doing pretty good, actually. Right? It's lining up pretty well. It's tracking well. Okay, so this is position or displacement if I have it labeled. Okay, I want to get to acceleration from this. What do? Take two derivatives of it, right? Okay. Well, let's take one derivative. Well, what happened there? Right? I effectively, in this case, you can think about this being two different sine waves. Right? Sine of, what's that? 1/6. So a 6 hertz cosine wave here. And I have some higher frequency on top of that. Right? This is wiggling at a higher omega. What's the derivative of sine omega t? Well, it's omega cosine omega t, right? So if I have some high frequency noise inside that wave, when I take its derivative, that multiplier comes out front. So that's what happens here. Okay. So the high frequency has a higher kind of multiple coming out front when you take the derivative. What do you think is going to happen if I take another derivative? Same thing happens. Now I have a sensor that looks great in position, measuring displacement, gives me really bad acceleration data. If I just kind of blindly take two derivatives of it. Okay. Exactly right. Hold on to that thought. Okay. Can I go the other way? Can I go from accelerometer data to position data? Okay. So here's actually some accelerometer data from my iPhone. There's actually apps you can get, right? It'll tell you you have accelerometers in your phone, right? A bunch of them. Right? You can get vibration data from your phone. Right? So here, just I think I dropped it, put it back up to the exact same position, and held it there. Okay? So this is the acceleration, x, y, z. Can we get back to what I did? All right. So how do I go from acceleration back to position? Do integrations. Okay. So there's, I show my acceleration, and now I have the velocity on that curve. And we add the position. When you try to go from acceleration to position, you're going to get drift. Because all this noise in the accelerometer is not necessarily centered around zero. Right? So when you integrate it, it's going to add up in one direction or the other and cause you to drift away from zero position. So if you're trying to go from acceleration to position, you need to be careful of drift. When you're trying to go from position to acceleration, you need to watch out for noise, effectively. Okay? So the kind of main point of all this is basically if you're trying to switch domains with sensor data, be careful. Don't just blindly take derivatives. Okay? You're going to go get in a bad place either way. Okay? There are advanced algorithms to combine multiple sensors, to be smarter about how you're taking those derivatives. If you know the dynamics of the system you're measuring, you can take that into account when you're doing those derivatives and processing that sensor data. Right. Most common of those is called a Kalman filter. So it was developed during the space race, basically. Okay. So kind of the main point of those six slides is be careful when you're switching domains. That's kind of a beginner mistake typically that most people, you'll probably have to make it in your career at least once before you remember, but just be aware of that. Okay, so talking about sensors in your kit, you have a few. You have a couple different potentiometers, right? So you have two, kind of a thumb, little blue one, and you have a big panel mount one. Both of those change resistance based on where you turn the knob. So old school radios, that's how they changed the volume. That potentiometer just basically changed how much current was going to the speaker. All right. You have a soft potentiometer. So let me take some of these out. You can take a look in your kit, make sure you have them all. Mine probably will look a little bit different. So your potentiometer, you should have a little bluish one like that, 3 feet to it. And you should have a panel mount one. I think I don't have that one here. Yep, okay. Okay. You should have a soft potentiometer that looks something like this one, but I think a little bit shorter than mine. This guy will change resistance based on where you squeeze it. Which one is flat? It probably might say ribbon sensor, yeah. Okay, yep, that linear soft part or ribbon sensor. Yours is probably shorter than this one. Again, this is going to change resistance based on where you squeeze it or where it has force applied to it. Okay? The blue one, basically, is what we're talking about right now. One with a blue bottom. Okay? You have a flex sensor, which is kind of the goldish brown looking one. I think yours is actually a little bit longer than mine, than this one. Okay? This guy will change resistance based on how far it's flexed, hence the name flex sensor. Okay? Finally, you have a force sensitive resistor, which has a little round pad on it, on the end. Okay? This guy will change resistance based on how hard that circle is squeezed. So let's step through those in context of your final project. All right. Let's start with the potentiometer, right? It's going to change its resistance based on rotation. So how could I use this as a sensor for your final project? Right. So I could connect this, or let me make sure I show you guys one. Mind if I look in your kit for a second? I was going to show. Where's the big guy? This one. You also have a panel mount potentiometer. It's probably going to be better for what we're talking about right now. Okay? So it looks like this. Looks really like a knob. If you're an electric guitar player, these are what's in your pedals and electric amplifiers. So you could attach that potentiometer to some kind of joint and then be able to read the angle that joint is operating over. So an elbow or something that's swinging out. That potentiometer is attached to that joint. You can know what angle it's at and get feedback. Okay. How about maybe the flex sensor? How might I use this guy? Man, it changes resistance based on how far it's flexed. Yeah, I could put that on the arm too. So instead of reading just the joint angle, I could have this laid against the side and see how much it's flexing. The flex would tell me something about the angle of it. Okay. How else could I use this, you think? Exactly right. So we talked about, can I run into the center section? Well, you can, but you also could stick this out the front of your device, and then you know when it gets bent, you're running into something that's in front of you, it might be time to stop. Right? So you can use this as a sensor to let you know how far I need to drive forward or move forward to get to the center section, maybe. Keep driving as long as this is straight. The sensor reading exceeds some kind of value, then stop. Right? Yeah, you have control over that in your code. Okay. How about the ribbon sensor? The soft potentiometer. Yeah, the one with the kind of bluish bottom. Yeah, so I could have this in the gripper, maybe, if I have some kind of gripper design, and know how much force I have effectively or where the force is on whatever I'm trying to grab. Certainly. Other ideas for this one? Yeah, so maybe if I'm trying to smash down and get something. Yeah, so some kind of falling arm or something like that, I can measure where did it hit and when did it hit maybe. You could use this almost as a switch. If I sense any kind of push on it, I know something, two things have touched. Right? So you have, while these are kind of simple sensors, they can give you a lot of information about what's going on about your machine. You just think about it a little bit. Okay. You're going to get another one that's part of your kit that each of your team will get. It's an IR sensor that gives you distance information. So in addition to being able to know flex and forces and those kind of ranges, you're going to have that information available. Okay. So now that we know what those are, let's talk about how to use them.